Some central Illinois communities have among the highest segregation levels in the nation in housing and in schools. Peoria and Springfield, for instance. Bloomington Normal has a large racial divide in poverty rates and median household income. Also among the most stark in the nation in those categories. That's according to Governing Magazine reporters Daniel Vach and Brian Charles, who've done a six-part investigative series looking at a half-century of government data. They join us via Skype. Brian Charles says the lingering segregation is part of the way northern industrial cities developed, with African Americans leaving the South to get away from Jim Crow and to chase industrial jobs. He says they ended up settling in the central core of many cities in the upper Midwest.
One of the things that we did in the series was to not necessarily, and this is often counterintuitive to news, is to say, well, we're going to look for what's necessarily different. We're going to sit there and try to find patterns that repeat themselves often, and then look at the unique conditions on the ground within each one of these cities that allowed those patterns to repeat and kind of manifest themselves over and over again.
Well, if Jim Crow and the Great Migration set this up, and it wasn't until the 70s or so that perhaps banking regulations allowed the pattern to change. Why is it still stuck here? How persistent should we expect the pattern to be? Bloomington Normal has had a lot of growth since then, and yet the we're less segregated than Springfield or Peoria, but we're still, you know, fairly segregated.
First of all, the timing of the growth matters. You know, in Bloomington Normal, a lot of the growth in white-collar jobs and what have you has come more recently. So what happened in places like Peoria and Springfield and Rockford is that they kind of hit their peak, and then there wasn't a lot of growth. So what you'll see is outside of the industrial belt that Brian talked about, you'll see more integrated neighborhoods because there's more development just all around. Whereas there's not a whole lot of resources to go around in some of these downstate communities. It is very persistent, though. And the problem is that at some point you have to figure out how to break the mold of how your city is set up. So if folks in Peoria, if black people are living on the south side and whites are moving to the north or across the river, you know, those development patterns, you know, where people are chasing, you know, where the greatest new subdivision is, the hottest new school, all that sort of builds on itself. And so people's perceptions build on itself, policy builds on itself. It's really hard to sort of pull back and say, you know, we're just, you know, perpetuating this over and over again.
Well, and also to dovetail on this a little, Dan's point a little bit, I mean, we mentioned like, the 70s when a lot of these laws changed, but look at is the fact that as these African American families start to arrive, they arrive at a point where we actually start to see industrial output around the country, especially in the industrial belt of the country, already start to decline. And then by the 70s and definitely by the 80s, you see factories start to either close or cut their staffing. So you can change the law at that point. But the amount of wealth that become concentrated by people, you know, who made money and were able to take those wages and turn them into housing investments and turning them into investments for their kids' college educations, up into the 70s, while African American families weren't able to do that. By the time they were able to do that, there's not an input of revenue. The jobs are gone, and so there's a couple ways you can kind of peel that. You can look at those African Americans from the South to some degree as late adopters to the Industrial Revolution. You can also look at it as when they do adopt the patterns of the work patterns of the Industrial Revolution, they are also precluded by function of government policy from taking advantage of the money that they're able to earn within those jobs. And then by the time they're able to actually take advantage through the change in policy, then the new jobs aren't there. So it's almost paradoxical.
Well, let's talk about income, because that is one way in which Bloomington Normal is absolutely typical of the rest of your analysis. The income disparity and the poverty rates for blacks and whites are huge for Bloomington Normal. In fact, well above the national average in terms of income disparity. It's seventh largest discrepancy in the nation. Is that because of State Farm's white-collar, white jobs expansion in the 80s and 90s, or solely, and the African Americans weren't brought along with that, or is that African Americans moving to Bloomington Normal from Chicago and taking these service sector jobs, or what is going on here?
Specifically with the income level, there are a few indicators that we have. You probably know the community, all the ins and outs a little bit better than ours. But I will say that, yes, the growth of State Farm, the growth of Illinois State University, you know, those tended to attract, especially State Farm, you know, higher paying white collar jobs. They didn't have Bloomington Normal compared to other places that we looked at, had a smaller black population to start with. There wasn't as heavy of a manufacturing base compared to a Decatur or Springfield or Rockford. And so they ended up in janitorial jobs and service jobs, you know, even before sort of the economy shifted to a service economy. The places where black families who did, you know, get to Bloomington Normal, you know, the most industrial they get is probably the railroads, that type of deal. But there wasn't sort of the same industrial base in Bloomington. So there wasn't that chance to, you know, sort of climb up to the middle class the same way that there would have been in some of these other cities.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Brian Charles and Daniel Volk, reporters for Governing Magazine, about a massive data crunch and a significant series on racial segregation that they have done on mid-sized communities in central Illinois. What should government be considering in policies to affect this dynamic?
We got some response back from some government officials, and I think the first thing that people have to do, and it wasn't something that people were not aware of when we got on the ground, is there needs to be some awareness and some initial conversations about this is a persistent problem. I think one of the things that we often do when we entertain this type of reporting is we look at this repeated pattern over and over and over again, and we don't say, well, somehow government doesn't have a role. But this is a matter of people choosing to move to a particular school district or people making choices about where they're going to live. And yes, there's an element of that that's true, but there's also an element of where government has a role in making sure that it services all of its citizenry. Give me an example, and not necessarily Bloomington example. If you go to Springfield and you go on one side of the town, you see not just beautiful homes, but you see things like curbs and gutters. Very, kind of a simple thing one might take for granted. But when you go over to the side of town in which black residents live, in, to the east side of town, you don't see curbs or sidewalks. And that's an issue of that's an infrastructure issue. That's an issue in which those roads, because they don't have curbs and sidewalks, are roads that on the edges of them crack more often, need more service, and don't really provide the type of aesthetic that says this is a welcoming place. Those are very subtle things. But those are very important things, and they mark a lot of how much government is interested in investing in your community. Now, you take that out to something like housing, and you say you see places in which one side of the town has homes that are more valuable than the other side of the town. And all those things kind of start to connect. That web starts to come together.
So some of the areas that we looked at were how school districts, especially small school districts, sort of preserve wealth or hoard resources. So in Bloomington, you have an interesting issue where, you know, you've got one school district surrounding another one, and sort of how that, if you're looking at how that would capture wealth as people, especially white wealthy people, move out to the farther areas. We looked at housing policy, so not just, you know, where you put in sidewalks, but, you know, where the big thing is where is rental property allowed to go. So blacks are twice as more likely to be renting as whites, and that has a lot to do with some historic dynamics. So where you site rental properties, what sort of restrictions are in single-family houses, where does the public housing go, where's the low-income housing tax credit-supported housing go? There's a lot of interlocking policies that matter.
That would suggest it's fairly intractable.
I don't think it's intractable. I think we also, you know, point out instances where there have been progress made. But the issue is that it takes a community effort to sustain it, and it takes an awareness of what you're actually going for. So the convenient thing is, and the easy thing is to do the status quo. You really have to sort of put out a sustained effort in order to sort of reverse course.
I mean, you look at right now, there is a movement that is bubbling up in some cities around the country to upzone cities. I mean, if you were to have that in a lot of cities, you'd have the opportunity to build more rental and more affordable housing intermixed among cities and potentially in metro areas. And that would give families the opportunity to go to places to get their kids into better schools and to do things to improve their position in life. I mean, that would be a government policy that one could pursue that would integrate your community a little bit better. And that's not something that's not possible. There's quite a few communities around this country that are considering it at this point.
There is also, apart from these institutional factors, there are cultural factors as well. Research done more than 10 years ago at Illinois Wesleyan University suggested that also significantly important in the choice of where to live, along with income and the affordable housing patterns that you've laid out, is a cultural sensibility that people tend to move closer to people who think like they do, who look like they do. We've seen that in the South Asian community, the Indian community in Bloomington Normal, and you allude to it in your series when you've noted that an influx of African Americans have tended to move adjacent to the traditional African American neighborhoods. How do you get around that self-segregation?
I think we want to be careful in how we talk about that, too, because a lot of the self-segregation ends up being on whites. So other research, particularly at the University of Illinois, Chicago, has looked at sort of what social networks and sort of how blacks and whites perceive this differently. So basically what it comes down to is blacks are more comfortable with diversity than whites. And at some point, you know, the threshold of, you know, how many whites can be in the community for it to be diverse versus how many blacks is different among blacks and whites. You know, there's a tipping point at some point, and I think there's the researchers haven't figured out exactly where that is, but if a neighborhood gets too black, then whites flee. On the other hand, you know, there are black families that are looking for an integrated, you know, neighborhood where they're not necessarily, they don't want to be vastly outnumbered, but they also don't want a, you know, 100% black neighborhood. So there are people that like to be near their family, near their church, near their other sorts of, you know, businesses. But I think that's not the entire story. I think a lot of what you need to be looking at is, you know, where, what are whites, how are they responding to diversity in their communities, and what are they comfortable with? Because they're in the majority, they have more of the resources, and sort of they're driving a lot of these development patterns.
That gets us back to community will and political will then. Are whites sufficiently aware of the pernicious effects of these patterns to want to change them?
Honestly, I think that a lot of whites will spend most of their time in white neighborhoods, and blacks will spend a significant amount of time in black neighborhoods. And the segregation is, I mean, one of the problems is that it's hard to get your head around if you're not sort of actively, you know, sort of challenging it. But it is possible to be in a, you know, majority white community and see very little of the majority black neighborhoods. You're not thinking about the challenges that having that separation, you know, has on investment, you know, infrastructure or schools or whatever it is. So I think it is hard, and that's why it needs to be something that, you know, local officials, journalists, you know, other thought leaders need to be cognizant of and thinking about, because otherwise it's very easy to get comfortable in how the way things are.
Also affecting the ability of sustained governments to sustain political will is community resources. And many mid-sized communities in Illinois and really throughout the nation are seeing flat to falling sales tax bases that would help nudge the needle on this. They're seeing a number of things that limit the ability of government to do much at all beyond basic core services. Do you see that as a significant hurdle, or is there a workaround?
It is a hurdle, but it's not an insurmountable one. I mean, the thing is, if you go to, you know, Bloomington, if you go to Peoria, if you go to Springfield and Rockford, there are booming areas. There are places where investment is coming in. There are resources available. So, you know, I mean, a lot of it is sort of how do you harness those resources? How do you, you know, some of it, you know, you talk about political, is like, you know, is that on the wrong side of a boundary? You know, how do we bring it on our side of, you know, like political, like, you know, on a suburb rather than the city and a different school district, that kind of deal. Those are problems that can be addressed. But I mean, even in areas that are legitimately struggling with their budgets, there are still resources available. It's a matter of trying to figure out how to get the right incentives and how to get people to harness the resources that are available. I mean, there are nice, comfortable places in all these communities that we covered.
Brian, I know that your series has caused links to it to fly fast and furious around this community, and I believe in Springfield and Peoria as well. Obviously, a conversation starter is what journalists hope for. What else do you hope comes out of this big effort here?
You know, yes, the conversation is important, but I think the other thing is that there's an opportunity for some of these communities to start to try to address these situations and create potential solutions for this that maybe other communities could follow, right? I mean, at heart, at the end of this, the idea that these are communities is kind of the central principle, right? And if you have a community, there's got to be some level of everybody coming together to work on problems together. There may be some level of self-segregation, as you may say, and that may happen across cultural boundaries. But in the end, Bloomington, Rockford, Springfield, Peoria, they have some common issues. And everyone has kind of an interest in solving those problems. And you can't do that if the community is chopped up and divided along lines of race, especially when you have folks on one side of that line that have far less resources than folks on the other side of that dividing line. I don't know if you took race out of this and this was purely a matter of just people being poor in a particular part of the city and there wasn't a racial division. I don't know if people would allow the situation to exist, is what I would say. You know, I think people would say, well, that's part of our community and we need to fix that. And so sometimes what happens when we include race is there may not be as much of an interest in trying to address the issue. And I think the reporting actually to some degree shows that. So what I would hope for in this is that, yes, the conversations, which talking to policymakers who've responded since those conversations are happening, but what I would hope is that those conversations lead to some folks thinking about a myriad of policies that would address everything from housing segregation to school segregation to the way fines, fees, and law enforcement affect the African-American community in those towns.
Brian Charles and Daniel Vock are reporters for Governing Magazine. They have done a series looking at a half century of data in a big analysis of segregation patterns in central Illinois communities. Gentlemen, a big achievement. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is Sound Ideas.